The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today we are sort of peeling back the layers on a really famous period, Renaissance art, trying to get past some of the myths.
Exactly. We're aiming to go beyond just, you know, Leonardo, Michelangelo, the idea of the lone genius. We want to understand what the art actually did. What was its function back then?
Right. And for this, we're leaning on the fantastic work of Geraldine A. Johnson.
Yeah.
She's a really distinguished art historian at Oxford.
And our mission here, it's pretty clear, I think, not just admiring the beauty, the masterpieces, but really getting into the why. The function, the context, the social purpose.
Yeah, those aha moments, right? When you suddenly see why something was made, not just what it looks like.
And honestly, that shift in perspective is huge. Because when you stop seeing these things as just like silent objects in a museum.
And start seeing them as active parts of society, maybe political statements or teaching tools or status symbols, suddenly it all feels much more, well, relevant.
Yeah.
You see echoes today in how things get funded, how power works.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about our guide, Geraldine A. Johnson, professor of history of art at Christ Church, Oxford, known for being incredibly thorough.
Yeah, rigorous is the word.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes her approach really stand out is that she's a social art historian, fundamentally.
Meaning
she's not just looking at the art in isolation. She's weaving together art, politics, religion, economics, seeing art as, you know, a product of its entire time, a complex thing.
And importantly, she brings in perspectives that maybe got overlooked before.
Definitely. She really highlights the role of women, especially as patrons, as viewers, particularly in the home, the domestic sphere, which gives us a much richer, less male-dominated picture than some older accounts.
So she's not just repeating the old stories.
Not at all. She synthesizes a huge amount of research, primary sources, stuff from archives, but makes it accessible. She's really good at guiding you through complicated ideas without dumbing them down.
Great. So her main argument, the big picture, what is it?
She argues the Renaissance wasn't just this simple rebirth of classical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was a massive transformation in art, yeah, but one that mirrored these huge shifts happening in culture, society, intellectual life.
Yeah.
From the 14th to the 16th centuries.
A synthesis, old, new, medieval, all mixed together.
Precisely. And the core insight, the real game changer in her very short introduction, is that this art was functional. It was deeply embedded in daily life, tied into everything, politics, religion, money, social status.
It wasn't just art for art's sake.
Absolutely not. She's really challenging that romantic idea of the Renaissance man working alone in his studio. It was much more complex, more like an ecosystem, a business even.
So for us listening, the shift is away from just listing famous paintings and more towards understanding the systems, who paid for it, why. How did artists actually work? How did places like Florence and Rome influence each other?
Exactly. Asking, what job was this art supposed to do? That's the key question.
Okay. That leads us right into this idea of myth versus reality, the romantic image of the artist. That comes largely from Vasari, right? His Lives of the Artists.
Well, Giorgio Vasari, writing in the 16th century. Hugely influential, but you could almost call it, well, Renaissance PR in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
He really built up that solitary genius's myth.
But you mentioned the patron held the power. I always pictured Michelangelo as this towering figure, but Johnson suggests the patron was really in charge. How did that actually work?
Well, it often meant negotiation, constant negotiation, sometimes friction. The reality on the ground was the bottega, the workshop.
Ah, the workshop system.
Right. It was collaborative, businesslike. A master artist ran it, but had lots of assistants doing much of the work. Mm. And above everyone was the patron, almost always the dominant partner in the relationship.
The book gives the example of Michelangelo and Pope Julius II. Sounds like they clashed quite a bit over the Sistine Chapel ceiling and the Pope's tomb.
Oh, absolutely. That relationship is a prime example. It
yeah.
shows creation wasn't just pure artistic expression. It was driven by the patron's agenda, political, spiritual, personal ambition. The person footing the bill called the shots, basically.
Okay, so the patron pays, the artist creates, often through negotiation.
Yeah.
And then where the art ends up matters hugely.
Location, location, location. Johnson makes such a strong case for this. Taking a piece of art out of its original context, a church, a public square, a private home, fundamentally changes its meaning.
Right. You stick it on a white wall in a quiet museum and you lose all the noise, the ritual, the everyday life it was part of.
Think about those famous David sculptures, Donatello's, Michelangelo's. They weren't just studies of the human form. Standing there in Florence, in a public space.
They were political symbols.
Powerful civic symbols, embodiments of Florentine pride, defiance against their enemies, very much active political statements.
And things like fresco cycles, like the Sistine Chapel again, or Giotto's Scrivegni Chapel.
Exactly. Not just individual pictures. They created an entire environment. Immersive, sequential narratives meant to guide your thoughts, your prayers, even how you move through the space.
And the technical innovations like perspective. You mentioned that wasn't just about making things look realistic.
Right. Linear perspective, perfected by Brunelleschi, used so powerfully by Masaccio in his Holy Trinity fresco. It was way more than a clever visual trick.
How so?
It was like a philosophical statement. It suggested that humans could understand God's creation, the visible world, through rational, measurable observation. It was about the power of the human intellect, in a way. A theological viewpoint, almost.
Wow. So even the way they painted reflected a whole worldview. Did that extend to the materials they used?
Absolutely. Materiality was packed with meaning. Choosing marble versus, say, terracotta, or bronze versus oil paint. It spoke volumes about cost, permanence, status, the kind of message the patron wanted to send.
And you see different approaches in different places too, right? Like Venice versus Florence or Northern Europe.
Yeah, definitely. In Venice, think Titian, that emphasis on rich color, atmosphere, light. Often using oil on canvas, partly because of the damp climate.
Okay.
Contrast that with, say, Jan van Eyck in the north. Incredible detail, complex symbolism, sharp realism, different materials, different climates, different artistic, and maybe even theological priorities led to really distinct styles.
So we've talked churches, public squares, but art wasn't just for grand public spaces, was it?
No, and this is a crucial part of Johnson's work, the domestic domain.
Mm-hmm.
Art was deeply woven into the lives of wealthy merchant families, especially around key life events, rites of passage.
For women, particularly.
Often, yes. Think about things like Cassoni, these lavishly painted marriage chests. They held the bride's dowry, but the paintings on them often showed stories promoting virtues expected of a wife.
Practical and symbolic.
Exactly. And deschi da parto birth trays. Beautifully decorated trays celebrating a successful birth, often passed around among the women attending the mother.
That really brings it down to a human level. It shows women weren't just passive bystanders. They were users and viewers of this art within their own sphere, the home. Art serving very real domestic functions like celebrating marriage, ensuring inheritance.
Yeah, it's a side of the Renaissance we don't always hear about. And finally, there's the whole relationship with antiquity, with the classical past.
The rebirth part.
Well, yes and no. Johnson is clear it wasn't simple imitation. It was more like a creative dialogue.
What does that mean exactly?
Artists selectively borrowed ancient forms, think Roman sculptures, mythology, anatomy, but they adapted them. They transformed these pagan forms to express contemporary Christian ideas or the patron's specific needs. It was a synthesis, honoring the past, but making it new and relevant.
Okay, so pulling all this together, what are the big themes, the main messages we should take away from Johnson's approach?
I think the first one has to be the primacy of the patron.
Right. Their money, their ambition, their vision is literally embedded in the artwork. To understand the art, you have to understand who paid for it and why. Follow the money, follow the power.
And the reflection for today is pretty direct, isn't it? Look at anything major being created, a movie, a tech platform, a news outlet. Who's funding it? Their goals are shaping the outcome, just like the Medici-shaped Florence.
Hmm. Okay, theme two.
Art as functional and social product. Every piece had a job. Political messaging, showing off status, teaching religion. Like the Scrivegni Chapel you mentioned, paid for by a banker probably as atonement for usury.
Yeah, it breaks down that modern idea of high art being separate from everyday function. Back then, beauty and utility were often the same thing. A painted chest was art, furniture, and a moral lesson.
Exactly. And theme three, the transformation of artistic identity. We see the artist shift from being basically an anonymous craftsman in a guild
to becoming a named individual, a celebrity almost. Leonardo, Michelangelo. Their personal style starts to matter, gets documented.
And that reflects broader shifts towards individualism in the culture. It also establishes this idea of the artist intellectual, someone like Leonardo, merging art and science, which has had a lasting impact.
Johnson's way of looking at things gives us some really potent ideas, sort of memorable reframings. Let's share a few of those key concepts.
Okay, the first one really tackles how we experience this art today in museums.
She basically says, we must resist the temptation to view Renaissance art through the lens of a modern museum. These objects were not created to be silent masterpieces on a white wall. They were active, functional parts of a noisy, vibrant, and complex world. So you almost have to mentally put it back where it belongs.
Yeah, reconstruct the original scene in your head. The second concept flips the script on how we usually start analyzing art.
Right. Johnson suggests, before asking who made this, a more fruitful question for understanding Renaissance art is often who paid for this and why. The ambitions and motivations of the patron are inscribed in the very fabric of the work. Motive first.
Follow the why. And the third one takes us back to technique, specifically perspective.
She argues perspective was never merely a technical innovation. It was a philosophical statement about humanity's relationship to the visible world and our capacity to understand divine creation through rational observation. Technique as thinking. Every line had a purpose beyond just looking right.
So, thinking about applying this, how can we use Johnson's method today outside of art history?
Well, application one is just developing a sharper critical eye. Her approach asking about funding, purpose, context, values, you can apply that to anything you encounter. News, movies, advertising, corporate reports.
Media literacy, essentially.
Yeah.
Who paid for this message? What do they want me to think or do?
Exactly. Application two is understanding creative funding dynamics. That tension between the creator and the funder, Michelangelo and the Pope, or the Medici and their artists, that's still playing out constantly.
Yeah, in grant proposals, venture capital pitches, film studios. Understanding that power dynamic helps you understand why things get made the way they do.
And application three, it's about richer cultural appreciation. If you go to a museum armed with this contextual understanding,
yeah,
you move beyond just saying, oh, that's pretty. You start to grasp the deeper cultural weight, the why behind the what. It makes the experience so much more meaningful.
For me, the thing that was most surprising and frankly delightful was learning about the art in the domestic domain. Mm. The marriage chests, the birth trays, seeing how art functioned in the lives of women, marking these really intimate personal moments. It just made the whole grand Renaissance feel much more human, more relatable.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, the most valuable lesson is that bigger picture reframing. Art isn't separate from society. It is society reflected back. The lasting takeaway is to always ask those questions. What was this for? Who saw it? What did it mean to them then and there? That lens changes everything.
And ultimately, the way the Renaissance elevated artistic practice, seeing it as a serious intellectual pursuit alongside science or philosophy, that really laid the groundwork for how we value creative expression today, didn't it? It absolutely did. It shows the enduring power of understanding not just the object, but the intention and the context behind its creation, why it needed to exist.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.